Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, well, let's get started. Welcome back. What our tradition is now is to do introductions. I'll start. Jeff?
Douglas?
I'm Len.
Freddie?
Adam?
Barb?
Joe,
Sam,
Niall,
Keith,
my name's Gary,
I'm Tom,
Patrick,
my name's Cass,
I'm Jack,
I'm David Cannon,
I'm Shunton,
my name is Ray,
my name is Michael,
my name is Jerry,
I'm Lee,
Diane,
Jose,
my name is Joe,
Jay,
I'm Brad.
George.
My name is Tate.
David.
Peter.
Okay. A couple people came in after we started meditating. Has anybody never been here before besides Scott and Keith? Okay. Great. Today it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, John Coleman. He's a Jesuit priest and associate pastor at St. Ignatius Church in San Francisco. He holds a doctorate in sociology from UC Berkeley, where he specialized in the sociology of religion. As a Jesuit priest, he is naturally interested in spirituality and his practices. Welcome.
Thank you. Before I get started, I've got a one-page handout, so if somebody would help, there's plenty of them. I pass them out so everybody's got a copy. This way you'll be able to follow it, and you'll get my reflections all week till that happens. I was here last year. Some of you may have been here when I was here last year. I gave a talk. I was asked. I've known Ray Dyer for 28 years, I think it is, something like that, since about 1985. And so he invited me here last year to talk about Thomas Merton and Buddhism, because Merton, of course, had had a long interest in both Zen Buddhism and other forms of Buddhism, and had met the Dalai Lama, and in his Asian journey had gone and visited Buddhist monasteries. So I was invited back to give a second talk, and the topic was, at least when Ray called me, was mysticism and meditation, Buddhist and Christian. So that's what I'm going to talk about. Let me begin, however, by sharing a poem by a dear friend of mine, who, like me, was a sociologist, Ralph Lane, a professor for many years at USF. When Ralph retired, he took writing courses and wrote poetry. And this poem is called, I'll Never Be a Mystic. I'll never be a mystic, and to be honest, I'm not really trying, though it all sounds so subtle and seductive. Letting go of self in Sufi wisdoms, dancing until empty, whispering mantras, blotting out the world, peace and seeds of wheat, shared in silence with brown sandaled brothers waiting for a voice to embrace. I know that's not for me, because I'm stuck here working with those I love. Oh, they're easy, trying now and then to show I care a little for others. So unlovable. Perhaps I'm like the rich man who went away sad, buried in the Bible, whose fate we do not know, for he and I and millions like us leave so few traces. We think compassion is the key. It's a full-time job. And I know, because the thorn keeps distracting me, and there isn't time or inclination to escape the web that covers me. I reread that because I was reminded that most Christians and most Buddhists would not ever say they were a mystic. But it might be worth asking what might be missed, even if we don't think we are mystics or called to be mystics, if we don't pay attention to the kind of thing they represent for us. I was once asked by a Jesuit friend of mine whether I'd ever had a mystical experience, and of course, if I had really, I suppose the answer would have had to be silence, because mystics don't go around claiming often that they are. But I did share an experience with him I'll get to the definition of mysticism in a moment, but had about it something of a mystic quality. I had spent a month in Japan, and I was working, and I went for some days to Kyoto, of course, one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And one morning, it was in February, so it was very cold, and it was not snowing, but it had snowed recently. Rather early, I went up to the Ryonji Temple, a Buddhist temple in Kyoto, where there's a Zen garden that's 1,000 years old, sand and rock formations. And I sat there quietly, distracted for a while with ideas and, you know, 1,000 years and who had been here, until I lapsed into, I can't tell you what I lapsed into, because something about mysticism, and we'll talk about that, is ineffable. But I spent about an hour there in silence. And then I got up and was walking down the hill. I was going to a Merino missionary center. I can't tell you what the experience was because I can't put it in words. But I can tell you what my reaction was. I said to myself, if this is the only experience I've ever had, notice I can't tell you the experience, there's something ineffable about it, that alone would be enough to have ever been born. And then I said, much to my surprise, and if I was born and every other experience was miserable and suffering, and yet I had this, still it would be worthwhile. Okay, so I want us to... I give you two, I think, helpful sources that I used among many. Actually, I got more intrigued by this topic. Ray said, oh, you can do it off the top of your head, but it turned out I did more reading and study of it. And two things that I found really helpful. One is a book by William Johnston called The Still Point, Reflection on Zen and Christian Mysticism. Johnston was an Irish Jesuit who taught at Sophia University in Tokyo and spent a large part of his life in dialogue with Buddhists, particularly interested in Zen Buddhists. He sat in Buddhist, you know, sittings, and he also went to a Roshi, a Buddhist master. And the second is, I can only say about it, is absolutely magisterial. There's nothing like it in any other language. It's written by somebody I know, we're not close friends, but I know, Bernard McGinn, who taught at the University of Chicago for many years and has done 5 volumes under the general title of The Presence of God, A History of Western Christian Mysticism. He's up now in the final, in his most recent volume, he's up to Richard Roll and The Cloud of Unknowing and Juliana of Norwich, so 15th century mystics, and I presume the next one will be Teresa of Avila, Ignatius Loyola, and John of the Cross for the 16th century. But in volume 1, The Origins of Mysticism, there's an appendix that is about as good as anything I know on this topic. As you can see, it's 80 or so pages. And it's called Theoretical Foundations, The Modern Study of Mysticism, treating theological, philosophical, and psychological and comparative approaches to mysticism. An aside here, when he treats the theological, Bernard McGinn is a Catholic, but he almost only treats of Catholic theological reflections, because as you probably know, the majority of Protestant theologians are very skeptical and wary about mysticism. Von Harnack and certainly Karl Barth. And the reason they are is because, to some extent, there's no question that Christian mysticism was deeply influenced by something other than the Bible. And it was interested by Neoplatonism, the famous Dionysius the Areopagite. I think they're wrong, though, to think that that's the only influence, because there were and still are forms of Jewish mysticism. And in the time of Christ, much of that Jewish mysticism was caught in the idea that you were brought, like in a chariot, to heaven, and you saw what was there, but you couldn't have words to tell it, and you shouldn't boast about it. And of course, when Paul talks about that, his own mystical experience, I can't boast, but somehow it was there. Was I in my body or not in my body? I can't tell you. But anyway, in that appendix, there's some treatment of William James, who I'll come to, and Baron von Hugel, the great English, he lived in England, of course the name is not English, writer on mysticism, a Catholic, Ninian Smart, who really does comparative studies, Rudolf Otto, Gershom Scholem, who's probably the most important figure of Jewish mysticism, Evelyn Underhill, you may have read her books, probably most people in the English-speaking world who are interested in mysticism start with her, and R.C. Zehner. To begin with, and it's important, and I'm going to probably stress one rather than the other, but important to know that there are two different strands of mysticism. Apophatic, that means without words. So the mysticism, which is the way of no words or images, that you, Zen after all is like that, but much of Christian mysticism, or some of it, John of the Cross, the cloud of unknowing, is about this, the negative path. Nothing, nada, 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 said John of the Cross. Or empty yourself, empty yourself, empty yourself. Get rid of all distractions and images, said the cloud of unknowing. So that's one kind. But then there's the mystical cataphatic, which means the way of images. That is, mystics who had images. So it's not imageless. It's not wordless. And of course, there are important figures. One thinks of the mystical marriage images among the Beguines, who are, at least for me, one of the most interesting of the Christian mystics, women in Flanders. And some who claim to have visionary experiences or to have heard words from God. I mean, Mother Teresa claimed that she had a voice that she was sure was a voice from God telling her that she was to leave the religious order she was in and to start working with the lepers by starting a new order of nuns in India. And then later in her life, she had great, enormous dryness. Okay, so I'll probably talk more about the adiphatic, because that is the apophatic, because that is congenial with Buddhism, but there is a kind of Buddhism which goes by the way of images too. Okay. Now, one of the difficulties is, how do you define mysticism? And if you went through that appendix of volume one of Burning Again, you'll begin to see that it's defined very differently by very different people. And so what the hell are you talking about? Oh, it was a mystic landscape. Well, what does that mean? But so it's difficult. Louis Dupré said no definition could be both meaningful and sufficiently comprehensive to include all experiences that at some point or other have been described as mystical. Don Cuthbert Butler, a Benedictine, English Benedictine, who wrote about mysticism, there is probably no more misused word in these our days than mysticism. Nevertheless, there are some helpful ways, and one of the best, it seems to me, is William James in his classic book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, where he suggests four traits about mysticism. First, it's ineffable. Well, either in the Buddhist tradition, I, it, I, thou gets lost. There's no dualism. There's no subject-object when you have Satori. Well, it's ineffable, because how can you talk about something without using subject and object language? Christian mysticism is similar, although it's not that there isn't an object, but the self gets lost in God, in a union with God. The ground of its being and the ground of God's being is experienced as somehow... So it's ineffable by the nature of the case. Well, some people find it quite unusual then. If you can't talk about it, and if it's ineffable, then what the hell is it? It's probably... And so you'll see in that appendix, and again, also some... what I think are psychologically reductionist understandings of mysticism. The second thing that James claims about it is, despite it being ineffable, it is a kind of knowing, an intuitive, direct knowing, not with subject-object distinctions, but yet a kind of knowing. And sometimes people can say, I am so sure from this experience that you would have to kill me or I would die to deny it. Ignatius once said that about some experience that he had, that he was absolutely sure. So it's a kind of knowing, and we'll come back to that in terms of, well, what does that knowing mean for the mystic, and what might it mean for those of us who are not yet mystics? The third trait that James talks about is that it's transient. That is, you're not in that state all the time. At least from the Christian point of view, is, well, no, it isn't like you are experiencing the beatific vision here on earth. Or it isn't like you are always in that moment of Satori. And finally, passivity. In the sense that when people talk about it, it's something that happens to them, but it's not the effect of their efforts. Johnson gives the following definition. One descends to the still point or ground of the soul, finding a type of knowledge that is supraconceptual and therefore ineffable. A species of superthinking whereby one grasps the unity of all things. Now, this may be slightly too intellectualist a definition for something that's more experiential. Now, you know from Zen mysticism the famous saying, he that speaks does not know, and he that knows does not speak. Again, the ineffability of the thing. And in Buddhism, there's the notion that of Satori, at least in Zen Buddhism, breakthrough, enlightenment, mystical enlightenment, where there's no longer an I thou or an I it, but just is. And so Zen, of course, like many mystical traditions, begins with a spring cleaning, clean out all the debris, get rid of it, and a move toward the nothing. But when you reflect on it, paradoxically, that nothing or no thing is not just negative. Now, I'm going to come back to this in terms of the Christian thing, but the title of Mysticism and Meditation. I find it interesting that although meditation is a practice in Buddhism and central, rarely does Satori happen while one is sitting silently in meditation. Often it's you're walking down the street and... So, there's some connection, but it's not a guarantee, and it's not always so connected. I'll come back to that. Well, some of the Christian mystics are similar to Buddhism in the sense of the way of nothingness. John of the Cross, nada, his great thing, nada, nada, nothing, nothing. One of my favorite mystical writings from the 14th century English, we don't know who the author is, The Cloud of Unknowing. You are in a cloud of unknowing, and yet it's experience, but it speaks of forget, forget, forget. Speaks of a kind of, a spring cleaning, the dark night of the senses. You close off the senses. and the dark night of the soul, you close off reasoning. Emptiness, and then finally a union in love. Eckhart, Meister Eckhart, certainly one of the most extraordinary Christian mystics, speaks of the unnameable, unknowable, transcendent, that continuously recedes beyond reference. So you see that there's some similarity between Buddhism and Christianity, at least the apophatic thing. But I think Johnston does make an interesting point, and I quote him here. Here we see the loss of self and the destruction of subject-object relation, which is different from Zen in two ways. Firstly, in that it is a union of love. You're lost, the self is lost in the loving center of God. Secondly, while Zen is sometimes called meditation without an object, the author of The Cloud of Unknowing speaks of meditation without a subject. The self gets lost. Nor is this distinction, as he says, merely one of semantics. To forget self so that only God remains is different from forgetting everything until only self remains. Now, it's clear that, at least from the Catholic point of view or a Christian point of view, there's no clear path for Christian mystical experience. There are no maps as such. And I find this interesting. When Catholics come to canonize, like Teresa of Avila, a saint who is a mystic, there's very little look at the so-called mystic experiences. It's judged on love, humility, and the virtue of the saint, like anybody else. It's almost as if it's saying, well, we're not denying that these are useful things because the writings are promulgated, but that's not really what it's most about. And maybe something as similar is true for Buddhism. You know, there probably can be people, and if they're enlightened, they who know do not speak, but who think that they're enlightened and are deluded. Or people look at other Buddhists and say, well, I think he's enlightened, and they might be deluded. And I suppose the test is the goodness, the tranquility, the peace, the quality of the person. That's how you judge it. I want to raise something here because I think it's important. I'll come back to it. Catholics often talk about the difference between acquired versus infused contemplation. The first is what you would get in terms of ordinary acts of trying to pray, centering prayer, trying to love God and let God's love enter into your life. And the second is somehow total gift, somehow connected with the meditation practice, but not guaranteed by it. So I think both in the Catholic and the Buddhist thing, you know, you wouldn't expect somebody to ever have Satori who does not engage in the practice of meditation. But engaging in the practice of meditation doesn't prove or cause, really, Satori. So similarly, this kind of loss of self in the union of God that Christians speak of is not likely unless people are engaged in prayer and meditation, centering prayer or mantra repeated. But it doesn't guarantee or cause. Those terms are somewhat misleading, since all true union with God, at least from the Christian point of view, is a grace, even in that ordinary kind of prayer. But it is a way of saying that mystical union is not just a result of meditation techniques. There's an essay that I found really helpful. It's in a book also edited by Bernard McGinn, mainly about Meister Eckhart and the Beguines. Having lived in Holland and Belgium, where I used to visit the Beguinhofs, I know a lot about the Beguines. These were lay women. They weren't nuns. Some of them lived in community. If you've ever been in the lowlands, you probably have seen the Beguinhofs in places like Antwerp or Amsterdam or Bruges. These were lay women who, many of whom were mystics, not all of them, who started old folks' homes and orphanages and whatever and acted on their own. And one of them is a woman named Hadovich of Antwerp. And the essay is about Hadovich and Meister Eckhart, the great German Dominican mystic. And in an essay called The Wilderness of God in Both of Them, Dietrich talks about a cluster of topics that one finds when you talk about Christian mysticism. The simplicity or purity of the divine nature and of the soul. Well, if it's absolutely simple and pure, then no language will capture it. Because anytime you use language, you're complicating it. And the essential nakedness or barrenness, again, that apophatic tradition of no language. The mystery of God's simultaneous total transcendence and absolute immanence. And inasmuch as God is totally transcendent, always, even when he's immanent, any words we use about it are going to be misleading. Anything you say about God is going to be misleading. We have to use language and use similes, but any ones we use will not capture it because our language doesn't know how to capture the total transcendent. The self's detachment from all contingent reality. Empty, empty, empty. You know, the kind of spring cleaning of senses and images in Zen Buddhism. The soul's reversion to its source and the union of God and the soul is a kind of radical unitas. And the identity of God's ground and the soul's ground. And so you get this language of abyss, nothingness, darkness. Okay. Now I have a couple of questions that I think are worth pursuing, and I would, if my dear friend Ralph is still alive, we used to meet once a month for lunch, and he would often try one of his poems on me, and I'm actually in some of his poems. But, you know, I will never be a mystic. Is mysticism open to everyone, or is it just a special gift for an elite? Some people might be mystics, but it's not really open to everyone, either because from the Christian point of view, God is stingy to some. He gives a gift to you, but he doesn't give it to someone else, or because they don't have the capabilities of it, or whatever. But that's a very important question. And again, when you read the literature on mysticism, people have different views on that. John of the Cross argued that it's open to everyone. And Karl Rahner agreed. Karl Rahner is the great German Jesuit theologian, so important in Vatican II as a Caritas, and spoke of a mysticism of everyday life versus special mystical experiences. And it's interesting, Eckhart, for example, didn't think visionary things were all that important. He didn't seem to have any of them. So some mystics seem to have them and some don't, but is it all that important? Do you have to have that? This is not the same question, however, as one that Carl Jung, you all know who Carl Jung is, the great psychologist, asked, or whether there are types of temperament more attuned to mysticism, more connaturally drawn to mysticism. And I think the answer to that's probably yes. But that's a different question than could this still be open to all, but easier for some. And the second question the literature raises is, are there multiple forms of mysticism? Ninian Smart, who does comparative religion stuff, argues that there's a core, a similar core to all mysticism, that underneath what the Buddhist experience or the Christian experience, or the Jewish mystic, or the Muslim mystics, after all, extraordinary Muslim mystic, the Sufi mystic, mysticism, that it's all really underneath there's a common, absolute, similar core. Well, I have problems with that because inasmuch as we have to talk about the ineffable, it seems to me we only can do so as mediated by a tradition. And the traditions of Islam and Judaism and Christianity and Buddhism are different. So we use different languages. And so in that sense, I am reminded, it was one of the most brilliant talks I ever, when I taught for 23 years at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, and there was a guy there when I was teaching there who's a brilliant scholar, and himself kind of seemed to be a kind of mystic. His name is Daniel Matt. And Dan is the world's expert on the Kabbalah. And he gave us a lecture called The Varieties of Nothingness. Interesting title. In which he compared the Kabbalah, Jewish mystic sense of nothingness, Meister Eckhart on nothingness, and Buddhist sense of nothingness. And he had to argue that really, there are three different nothings. And I think it's the point is that it's really hard to say that there is some common core. And again, how would you find language that's interesting and not vague and petty to talk about it? Some Catholics have talked about natural versus supernatural mysticism. Usually as a way of saying, well, Catholic or Christian mysticism is supernatural and the other may be interesting, but it's natural. But again, Karl Rahner suggests that the grace of God and God's action are more universal than this distinction allows. At least in his view, in the real existential world, there is no simple natural. There's either grace, the presence of God, or sin, but there's nothing untouched by that. And if that's so, and we can't plot how God's action is, God can be acting in what the people want to call natural mysticism. Now, this actually was debated at Vatican II, and there were different positions. Rahner was quite clear that grace and God's action was, and the action of the Holy Spirit was bigger than certainly just what's found in the church, or bigger than we can plot. We can't measure it or set limits to it, and that therefore it can be found in all religions, and therefore you can have true dialogue, and etc. Another paritus at the council, again a Jesuit, Henri de Lubac, who had written a lot about non-Christian religions, argued that no, mysticism in Buddhism or other religions is an interesting, purely human phenomenon that has no real religious resonance for a Christian. And the Vatican II documents are a little vague on both of those because they both had power. But it has shown up since. John Paul II, or whatever you think about him, followed Rahner. He said, let's all go to Assisi, Buddhists and Muslims and Jews and Catholics and Protestants, and let's all pray together. And Ratzinger, who later became Benedict XVI, was horrified by that. Because Ratzinger followed de Lubac. Well, yeah, that's nice, but it's purely historical. Whereas John Paul followed Rahner, that God's action is bigger than we can. So that's it. It's interesting how. Two other things before I quote Johnson again. Just to make clear, the relation between meditation and mysticism. Probably no mystic ever achieves whatever is mystic breakthrough enlightenment without meditation, but it doesn't guarantee it. And in a sense, because of this language of passivity, it doesn't really cause it. Something has gotten at it that's not just the self's effort. And then back to that question of everyday, I may not be a mystic, but some people may be. At least from a Christian point of view, this is the way I reflect on it. Well, maybe I won't ever be a mystic. But by damn, I'm just saying what my own belief is. I'm called, like anybody else, if I'm going to be a follower of Christ, to love God and love neighbor, and to love neighbor As God loves the neighbor and even loved my enemy, today's gospel, the Good Samaritan, even as God loves my enemy, and I'm called to have a union with God. Just, oh, that's the most ordinary thing in the world. Okay. Well, the mystics in the Christian tradition achieve that par excellence. And it would be kind of silly for me, you know, and for us not to look at them to see, well, what might I be losing or what might be a clue to me? So it's quite clear to me that the knowledge that the mystic has is probably compelling to them. We can't, in as much as it's ineffable and we don't experience it ourselves, we may have a hard time talking about it, but in as much as we can read about it or reflect on it or read accounts of it, I think it's a compelling knowledge for us too. And then I'm going to end with, and then we take questions or comments, a comment of Johnson on dialogue. Again, this comment presumes that there isn't a core simple mysticism that's the same in all different traditions, that we are compelled to speak out of a language and a tradition. So, an unbridgeable gulf appeared to separate those who believed in the soul, the absolute, and the objectivity of truth from those who spoke of nirvana, nothingness, and the void. What united us, he said, was not a common tradition, but was religious experience. We shared religious experience. And there may be, and that sharing is important. I have a dear friend who is probably this country's expert on Buddhist-Christian dialogue. And he says, I'm less interested in finding what's similar or common. I want to pay attention to the differences that are interesting and that might make me look again at my tradition to see, well, do we have anything like that? And if not, gee, I regret that we don't have something like that. So that's the kind of dialogue that Johnson seems to be interested in. But as he says, we're still asking if a Christian Satori is possible, and if so, how it will differ from that of the Buddha. So I hope these remarks have been helpful. And now I'll take any comments or questions or whatever. It's a large and looming topic, by the way. Yes?
I'm not sure how relevant this is, but it seems to me that there's a lot of secular mysticism going on. People having these weird experiences and not knowing what to do about them.
Right.
And I'm wondering what you think of that. I'm thinking of like Ken Wilber's integral philosophy.
Right.
You know, there's Gyenpo Roshi has a big mind process that's supposed to give you Satori. Tim Freak, who's a psychologist, also has something called the mystery experience. And it seems to me, and there's also this, another big spirituality that's very in vogue called non-dualism.
Non-dualism, And of course, mysticism tends to get you somewhere toward non-dualism. Well, one thinks of nature mysticism, which is an important thing. Again, how to account this, but I will always remember this. This is one of them, and it's a nature mystic thing. I was a little kid. I may have been 3 or 4 at most, in the Santa Cruz Mountains with my parents, and we were staying at some friend's house, and I wandered off by myself and sat under redwoods, and I was stunned. These were older, bigger, more extraordinary than I ever would be. I mean, was that a mystic? But we do, the people do talk about nature mysticism. So yeah, I think if you were doing comparative studies, you would not only look at religion, but you would look at other forms. Yeah. So no, that's quite a relevant question. But the non-dualist thing, the kind of a knowledge that nevertheless is kind of ineffable, but you know, a lot of the things that would come out of talking about the religious tradition would be true of those secular ones. That's a very good question. Yeah.
You know, a lot of this stuff that you're talking about a little bit about me, like, yeah, for example. But I do
I was a professor all my life.
I do have. I mean, I know for me, my experience of mysticism usually has to do with some kind of experience, personal experience that I've personally lived through or, you know, had come into my life. So, and then this sort of just hits me over the head. But, I mean, I can remember, you know, back in the 70s when I used to drop acid every now and then, I definitely felt like I had some mystical experiences there. Now you can just say it's just some kind of chemical reaction, but I didn't think so. I don't.
Neither did Aldous Huxley, who also wrote about mysticism.
I mean, I definitely think that it opened my mind and opened, and I had an awareness of something I wasn't aware of without that going on. But the other thing is I wanted to ask you is...
Just a real quick thing on that. What's interesting to me, though, because I'm old enough to have remembered the 60s and 70s and dropping acid and whatever, and friends who did that, is how quickly the people at Esalen moved away from LSD to meditation. So I guess part of the answer is, yes, I'm not denying that Huxley may be right, that through LSD there's something like a mystic experience. But to sustain that, that may not be the way to go. Anyway, for what that's worth.
No, I mean, I don't think it's LSD is it. I think it possibly is a vehicle for one to see a different reality. That then one does not need on LSD anymore, but you are aware of this experience.
Right.
And so that's what I would say about that. But, but being brought up as a Mormon, Mormon tradition is very much involved in miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally was one of those miracles in my life when I was 8 years old. I was, and I don't know how miracles fit into all this, because when I was 8 years old, I was very sick with nephritis, and I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mormon elders
prayed. Yeah.
Put oil on my head. I was, as an 8-year-old kid, you know, I'm pretty innocent back then. I'm still pretty innocent. And 2 or 3 days later, I was cured.
Yeah.
And my mother, to this day, thinks of that as a miracle. Now, you can't deny the fact that actually I was cured.
Right.
And I don't, and me being, you know, and to this day, my mother's sending me pamphlets on, you know, this miracle that happened, and as evidence of the truth of the Mormon Church, and I'm not a Mormon anymore.
Right.
You know, so she thinks I'm some kind of a heretic.
Right.
But the point of the matter is, this did happen, and so how does that fit into?
Well, I think that's a slightly different topic. But, you know, I mean, I believe there's things like miracles. After all, in the canonization of a Catholic saint, you have to get something called a miracle. And what is that? You get doctors saying, the guy had cancer and it's gone, and we can't give you a medical explanation of it. And they invoked John Henry Newman or whatever. But, you know, that's what how a miracle is defined. And doctors do it. I mean, the case is... But I'm not sure it's connected necessarily with mysticism. It's a different religious phenomenon. Important one, but a different one, I think. Yeah.
Could you say more about your experience in Japan, and especially immediately thereafter, you know, the hour after or so? I assume you were by yourself.
I was by myself, yeah.
And did you have an emotional reaction or response?
Well, because I can't tell you what the experience was, but I did share that as I was walking kind of quietly, it came to me like lightning out of the blue. If this was the only experience I ever had in my life, and I never had any others, life would be worth it. And if all the rest of my experiences were misery and suffering, but I had this, life would be worth it. Well, that's it. Yeah, that's an extraordinary...
Well,
I don't know. I mean...
Did you continue on with your day?
Yes. I went and visited other, you know, things. I thought, and it was true, I may only get to Kyoto once in my life, and by damn, I'm going to see it. Yeah, but did you have that?
A friend of mine once made a sort of sweeping remark that the difference between the West and the East in terms of the at least the institution of religion or the exoteric forms, is that in the East, one is assumed one can have their own connection to God, and it sounds to me a lot like that's what mysticism would be, that rather than to look to a benevolent father or other external teacher or something, that one has their own direct experience.
Right.
Would you say that's...
Oh, yeah, yes, and of course, I'm a Jesuit, so Ignatius of Loyola was brought before by the Dominicans before the Inquisition for teaching something, which is in the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, which is a direct, immediate experience of God. And he had had one and said, you know, if he had more than one, but I mean, if I deny that, I'm denying who I am. And he never retracted. He would never retract that. Whereas the others wanted to say, well, God's grace always comes through the mediation of the church and the hierarchy, etc. So it's not totally East-West. There are people, a lot of people in the West who would hold that you have direct experience of God. They should. Your hand was up there.
Throughout my life, I've had a variety of mystical experiences that are all along the lines of everything you talked about. I've had natural, I've had supernatural, I've had in the moment, I've had knowing, and they're not forced, but they're not forced.
No,
but
right.
When I'm just sort of...
It's like a gift almost.
An alignment. I, as a creative artist, I've had the experience of where it's I and that oneness and nothingness is happening, and I'm watching my hand do something, both in it and watching it and seeing it and feeling it as both the larger. And so I've had those, and I've had probably the most supernatural was when my father died, and I could feel, and yet, and at the exact same time, my mother in another hospital had a fit, epileptic fit, the exact same. And the dog back at home was howling in the neighborhood at the exact same time. That, to me, was...
Not by chance.
Not by chance.
Yeah. Thank you.
So those are just...
Yeah, thank you.
I relate to all of
them. You had your hand up.
So let's see. So thank you for your talk. It's brought up a lot of thoughts for me. And I've had, as to the best of my knowledge, between one and four... One that I would say surely was a mystical experience, which I would call also transcendence. I don't think they're really seem really different, which in a way was sort of similar to yours in that I was driving back with a dinner from a friend by myself in the car, listening to music, and you know this suddenly happened. It lasted seconds or minutes, and it faded. But I still remember it some years ago. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is a Buddhist perspective. It seems to me the mystical experience, at least in the sense of transcendence, is an experience or an insight, and I'm not sure which or both, into the nature of reality. And that's what it's about. And the sort of question I had... which is, I'm sure, unanswerable, is might death be a mystical experience of transcendence? And it strikes me that the perspective on that from Buddhism would be, you know, from my view of Buddhism would be probably yes, but from the Christian perspective, in a sense, no, because as I understand it, the Christian perspective on what happens after death is there's still a separation between God and self. Live in heaven or...
There's a beatific vision, which is not totally separation, but there's two different questions. The dying and then what happens after death are two different things.
Well, I'm referring basically to after.
After death, yeah. Because the dying experience, you have these people who have near-death experiences and recover. Most of them do not recount anxiety or whatever, but there was a light drawing me toward it. Or, this was funny, because when my mother was dying, and I had a niece who was a nurse, and she said she's heard it before, my mother kept saying, "Do you hear that? There's wonderful music." So it is interesting that most of the people who do recount the near-death experiences. Yeah. They're positive and transcendent and quasi-mystical. What happens after death for the Christian understanding? It's hard to say. I mean, you continue somehow. You continue. You never collapsed in God. But, you know, one of the criticisms of Protestant theologians of the Catholic mystical tradition is they think it's a kind of pantheism, that somehow the self... I mean, after all, okay, I can put it in words, but suppose you experience this. My whole existence depends on the creative action of God, not just at some point back then, but at any moment. My whole existence, and that of all of the world, okay, depends totally on that. So my ground of being and the God's ground of being are somehow fused. Dualism is gone. Okay. So this is the kind of language Eckhart and others used. Okay. Now, for some people, they were saying, my God, that's, you know, deification of the person. That doesn't... Okay. But so who knows? Maybe something like what they have experienced is what the beatific vision will be. Although Thomas Aquinas said about the beatific vision, something I really like. Okay, I mean, just this language, whatever it is. I'm in eternity, I'm in heaven, and you know, experiencing what God is like. Well, wouldn't that get boring after a while? No, because God's transcendence is such that I will never be able to grasp it, even how deeply I experience it, you know. So it goes on forever because there's no limit to what it is. You know, and any experience I have doesn't really exhaust what the reality is.
You know? So it seems to tie into the nature of I and the other mystery of science, also the nature of consciousness.
Right, right. Yes, and see, some people who study mysticism, psychologists or whatever, they really don't care about any religious dimension to it. For them, it's just a human consciousness thing. But they can do interesting... I mean, there are interesting things to be found in that. Yeah?
You can ask this or not, but I'm just curious that when you're talking about standing in a tradition versus not standing in... If what tradition... If you feel like you stand in a tradition, and what...
I'm a Catholic.
And it's okay. And how does that...
A Catholic Christian.
How does that inform you in terms of this exploration?
Well, the way it informs me is, I mean, somehow then my understanding is that I emerge from the love of God. I'm called to let that in so that I can love others like God loves them, so that I can become who God wants me to be, and surprisingly, that may well be what I most really want to be. I want to find simple prayer techniques to let me there. And, you know, Jesus, after all, says, I and the Father are one. That's a mystic statement, and everyone who comes to me comes to the Father and is joined with him. That's also so. How do I find prayer techniques? There are different forms. Sometimes it's simple, much like a Buddhist, a centering prayer, sitting, breathing, maybe a mantra, a simple mantra, maybe not. Others are ways of images. You know, Ignatius was strong in the way of images. You know, but
well, that's a good place for us to.
Hmm?
That's a good place for us to end.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Very much. Announcements. Jerry.
Hi. The annual GBF retreat, September 20th, 21st, 22nd, about the Pani. I'm the registrar, so If you're interested in private accommodations, come see me today because they're going fast. We still have plenty of room in the dormitories. So if you're interested, just come see me. And if you need scholarships or anything like that, we'll talk about that. Okay.
So I'm the host today, and we have some really fresh plums from George's garden. I made a rice pudding, and hidden in that rice pudding is a single dried apricot.
Whoever gets that.
Whoever finds the apricot gets a special prize. If nobody finds it, I'll claim it, and John gets the prize. Let's see, so come and find me as I'm going down with Don Bo and claim your prize. There's tea, and if you have tea, please wash the cup in the sink. There's a sign-up sheet if you are new and would like to be on our mailing list. On the credenza, there's a sign-up sheet. If you would like to go out to lunch, there's a group that usually meets at 12:30 at the outside door, and you go out to some local place for lunch. So if you would like to do that, then you're welcome to do that. Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next week, actually not next week, there will be no GBF because there's an ordination here being held by the San Francisco Buddhist Center at the end of the year. So on the 28th, we'll have Emilio Gonzalez, who's a very well-known teacher of Qigong, Tai Chi. Mm-hmm. He's taught for many years, and he's taught a lot of Spirit Rock, has videos. And he has spent a lot of time teaching Qigong for help for people with HIV and other chronic illnesses. So that process is to be very good. So I'd like to re-welcome Niall and Guy. And let's close with our dedication of merit.
Thank you for your practice. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow, and may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives. If you're parked on the street, don't forget to
leave. Yeah, we'll do that right now.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.